This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. This week, Duke Energy announced its much-anticipated plan to drain coal ash ponds across the state and relocate the ash to central North Carolina. The five coal ash ponds outside Goldsboro's HF Lee plant are among the sites slated for cleanup. Lee Jenkins has more on the process.
Residents across the state have voiced their concerns about coal ash ponds for months. From contaminating Goldsboro groundwater to leaking 50,000 tons of ash into the Dan River, some ponds clearly pose a problem. Upper Neuse Riverkeeper Matthew Starr says Goldsboro's now defunct HF Lee plant is one such site.
Been a number of residents around the HF Lee facility who have been told, do not drink their water, do not cook with it. Your water is contaminated, and it's contaminated with really scary substances such as hexavalent chromium and vanadium.
Arsenic has seeped into the groundwater near the ponds, too, sometimes in concentrations 60 times higher than the state standard. In accordance with the Coal Ash Management Act of 2014, Duke Energy has announced its plan to excavate 12 ash ponds across the state, including Goldsboro's HF Lee plant. Duke Energy spokesperson Jeff Brooks says the company will be relocating the ash at the HF Lee plant to a retired clay mine in Lee County.
Line this clay mine with multiple layers of natural and synthetic barriers, and then we'll store that coal ash dry inside that structural fill, and then use that to be able to potentially reclaim that land for other purposes.
Brooks says the new basins were designed with security in mind. Duke Energy has begun installing several protective layers in the mine, along with a moisture collection system at the bottom. The company plans to extensively monitor groundwater near the basin as well.
We believe that it's an effective solution that recycles that ash and can use it for a beneficial purpose.
Not all are happy with the proposed relocation, however. Downeast Coal Ash member Mindy Robinson says that while getting the ash out of Goldsboro is a start, there are better solutions than just shipping it somewhere else.
It's pretty much just going to be dumped on another community that is really not okay with having it. Duke Energy really needs to be working with the UNC school system and everything to try to do some research and come up with some way to eliminate this problem for everyone.
There's also the matter of excavating the ash and transporting it to the new facility. Brooks says the company will complete its transportation plan within the next few months. Generally, Duke Energy uses rail to move ash from one site to another. Indeed, HF Lee has rail lines leading directly into the facility. Whether or not they're fit to use is another question altogether.
There are rail spurs that exist. What we have to look at is the practicalities of if that rail can be used to transport from the Goldsboro area down to the Sanford area where this material will be stored, and that's what we're looking at right now.
Whether by rail or by road, the process for transporting the ash remains the same. Duke Energy will moisten it prior to transport so it holds together like sand. They'll then seal it in an enclosed container to prevent harmful dust from escaping, washing down the vehicles as they enter and leave both the HF Lee plant and the clay mine basin. Downeast Coal Ash Coalition's Mindy Robinson worries more about the excavation process.
There would always be the risk of, you know, an accident happening and busting a pipeline or a dam or something like that and dumping a lot of this coal ash into the river because it's so close.
The HF Lee ponds are even closer to the Neuse River than the Eden facility ponds were to the Dan River when they burst in February of 2014. Robinson says she'd prefer the ash go towards something constructive rather than see it buried.
Apparently in South Carolina, they have set up those refiring processing plants right there on site where the coal ash ponds are. So instead of having to excavate it, move it, and then try to get it processed from wherever you moved it to, they were able to take it up out of the ground where it is right now, refire and process it into construction materials, and ship it out in a safe way.
Excavation can't begin until Duke finishes layering the mine itself. The company can still postpone excavations further, depending on how high a priority the state ranks the HF Lee cleanup as well. Riverkeeper Matthew Starr says he'd like the site cleared out as soon as possible, but knows it won't happen overnight.
We understand that Duke Energy cannot snap their fingers and have this cleanup happen tomorrow. So we will work to have this happen as soon as possible, but we have to also be realist and understand that this is not a simple process to go through.
I'm Lee Jenkins.
When the U.S. Coast Guard responds to an emergency off the North Carolina coast, they don't expect the call for help to be a hoax. Unfortunately, these events occur more than you think. Responding to false distress calls is not only expensive, it can put rescue personnel in dangerous situations. A local man was recently sentenced to prison for making hoax calls to the Coast Guard in October 2013. Sarah Finch has more.
It's the familiar fable of the boy who cried wolf, but in this case, with very costly consequences.
Mayday, mayday. Help, help. We're sinking.
In the case of Brandon Garner of Beaufort, there was no actual crisis. He and Charles Dowd Jr. both claimed that a vessel with 5 adults and 2 children was taking on water and sinking near the Core Creek Bridge in Beaufort.
There's 2 life jackets and there's 7 people. There's 1 still on the vessel. We're trying to get the other one off.
The Coast Guard received 69 calls over a 50-minute period. A helicopter from the Marine Corps Air Station at Cherry Point, a towboat from a local salvage company, and emergency responders from the sheriff's office and 2 fire departments were deployed to assist in the search and rescue effort. However, when response crews arrived within 40 minutes of the initial call, they found no vessel or people in distress. Ultimately, the U.S. Coast Guard determined the broadcast was a hoax. Calls like this are all treated the same way, as a genuine emergency. Command Center Chief for the Coast Guard in Wilmington, Lieutenant Lane Monroe, says they fielded 451 distress calls on the North Carolina coast last year, of which 7 are suspected to be phony.
The Coast Guard will always respond as if it's real. We will go through all of our procedures for search effort and asset allocation to make sure that we've exhausted a reasonably prudent effort to both advocate for the mariner who may be in distress, but also for the safety of the crew.
From the high seas to the coastal rivers, a marine band radio, or VHF radio, can contact the Coast Guard through Channel 16, which is the International Hailing and Distress Frequency. Lieutenant Monroe says with every Mayday broadcast received, the Coast Guard Investigative Service springs into action to verify the legitimacy of the situation.
During that effort, the Coast Guard will also conduct an investigative process, either through extended phone calls, broadcasts, queries of other vessels in the area, to try and determine whether or not this may be a reasonable broadcast or if it may be a hoax.
They work closely with local law enforcement and civilians who report additional imperative information. The Coast Guard can track the source of the marine band radio or cell phone signals through triangulation from 911 dispatch and cell phone towers. All of this evidence is then passed on to the U.S. Attorney's Office for a verdict on the case. Deputy Criminal Chief in the U.S. Attorney's Office, Felice Corpening, says it's a very serious offense to squander Coast Guard resources when no distress actually exists.
Their lives are put at risk every time they respond to a call. So when a person willfully and knowingly makes a false distress call, we will do everything necessary to prosecute that person to bring about the appropriate resolution to that type of behavior.
In addition to putting emergency responders in harm's way, fake Mayday calls tie up resources in the event of a real emergency. They're also expensive. Lieutenant Monroe says most rescue efforts cost $10,000 to $100,000. The price can quickly increase if the Coast Guard dispatches helicopters or calls in local fire department crews, ferry boat operators, or a Marine Corps rescue helicopter.
Any broadcast made to the Coast Guard with an intent to deceive where no distress exists would constitute a hoax broadcast or a false distress broadcast, and that's a felony.
Penalties for a false distress call can include up to 6 years in prison, a $5,000 civil fine, up to $250,000 in criminal fines, and reimbursement to the Coast Guard for any search efforts expended. Additionally, each transmission is a separate felony, and in the case of minors, parents or guardians would ultimately be responsible for their children's behavior.
Some of the adults are panicking, but probably 50 to 60 feet away.
After being indicted for making false distress calls, Brandon Garner recently pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 28 months in prison and ordered to pay over $18,000 in restitution. Last year, a similar case involving Homer Lewis Blackburn of Atlantic Beach incurred a sentence of 18 months in federal prison and more than $288,000 in restitution. Lieutenant Monroe encourages mariners who feel that they are in danger to never hesitate to call the Coast Guard. Any physical threat to life, limb, or property is a valid cause for their help.
Anybody at any time who believes that they are in peril or need assistance from the Coast Guard or are calling to report some sort of hazardous condition should always feel free and encouraged to call their local Coast Guard.
Lieutenant Monroe says they will continue to pursue all distress broadcasts as if they are real until proven otherwise. The U.S. Coast Guard has a long and proud history of life-saving operations. For over two centuries, they have safeguarded our nation's maritime interests along our rivers, ports, and at sea. Coast Guard presence and impact is seen and felt locally, with 9 boat stations along the North Carolina coast, from Jacksonville to Fort Macon, and from Elizabeth City to Oak Island. For Public Radio East, I'm Sarah Finch.
This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East.
I want to be a pediatrics orthopedic surgeon, so I'm kind of here for like the feel of the field.
It was a hot and humid day at the Onslow County Fire Training Grounds as campers learned what it takes to be an emergency responder. The Emergency Preparedness Summer Camp gave teenagers ages 14 to 18 an opportunity to train alongside law enforcement, fire, emergency medical, and public health officials for a week. Planning Officer for Onslow County Emergency Services, Andrew Jaspers, says the camp is in its 8th year.
We cover every aspect of emergency services, E911 communications, fire services, rescue services, swift water rescue. Anything to do with emergency services, we try to cover.
30 teens are attending this year's camp. Most of them are interested in pursuing a career in the field, including 17-year-old Jordan Carnes, who wants to be a paramedic.
My mom and dad were both law enforcement when I was growing up, so they have a lot of contact with the people who run the camp. So I thought it'd be something to really open my eyes and see if this is what I really wanted to do when I grow up or not.
By 11 o'clock, a group of a dozen teenagers rest in the shade of a fire training tower and sip on bottled water. Firefighting gear is strewn about.
All right, everybody, this is Brian, this is Sean, this is Lauren.
Fireman with the City of Jacksonville, T. Tallman, is leading today's training. He explains why emergency responders have to practice vehicle extrications.
As you're fixing to see here in just a minute, it's going to be very labor intensive. The most paramount thing, even out here training, even in real life when we do this, is safety.
After a short briefing, campers try on gloves, helmets, pants, and coats, and walk over to the training area where two junk cars are parked on gravel. Tallman explains the first step to a vehicle extrication is to place wooden blocks under the car so it doesn't roll.
We don't want that car rocking as much. You know, the patient could be compromised, especially if you got to cut them out. It's probably pretty bad damage. So you don't want to mess them up any more than they really are. So as you'll see these tools, they'll really put some forces on the car. You'll see it really move, shake, and pop.
But before the campers get to use the jaws of life or another powerful life-saving tool known as the spreader, they have to learn how to bust out windows and saw through the front windshield. 16-year-old Jeremy Wilson was happy to volunteer.
Hey, there she goes!
Never really bust glass like being allowed to, so it was kind of fun today.
Using an extrication glass breaker, which is similar to a small pickaxe, campers took turns smashing and sawing through the windows. Today's demonstration is a fun learning event, but Sean Kistner with Onslow County Emergency Services says breaking a window to reach someone trapped inside a vehicle is a very real emergency scenario.
Basically what they're doing is breaking the windows so they can get somebody inside of the vehicle to cover the patient up to keep the glass off of them, and then that way they can get in there and check for the status of the patient, maybe gain an IV or something along those lines if we can get a paramedic inside the vehicle.
Once everyone had a go, Tallman suggested the campers take a break and cool off in the shade before the next activity.
If you feel like you're not feeling good, you feel dizzy, lightheaded, or just getting too hot or anything, please let us know, okay? There's nothing wrong with that. All right? All
right. After drinking water, it was time to use the heavy machinery.
You got open and you got closed, okay? You want one hand on the handle, one hand back here.
Tallman instructs each camper as they operate the jaws of life, a hydraulic device used to cut the hinges off the door.
In any circumstance, we'd really like to go ahead and get access so we can cut that nader bolt. When it's finally cut, it's definitely not as explosive. Come in here and look. All right, hold up.
The other tool, the spreader, pries apart the door until the hinge snaps and the door falls to the ground.
It was pretty awesome knowing that you're kind of like in control, sort of.
Camper Hannah White sits the tool on the ground and walks over to the shade to rehydrate.
I put myself through it like I was pretending like one of my loved ones were in that car and just like trying to get them out like that. It's pretty awesome.
Hannah dreams of being a professional softball player, but if that doesn't work out, she says she wants to be a firefighter. It's stories like this that inspire emergency responder for Onslow County Emergency Management, Lauren Sesnat. She's helped out with the summer camp for 3 years.
I think it's educational in two ways. One, it allows them to see what our job does and what that entails. And then it also allows them to understand how safe they need to be as they grow up and drive vehicles and that things like this can actually happen. And that's why we're trained to, you know, help and protect the community.
For City of Jacksonville fireman T. Tallman, the week-long summer camp is about motivating teenagers to think about a career in emergency management.
Nowadays, it requires a lot of training to get hired on, EMT, firefighter 1 and 2. And in a lot of cases, it takes a college degree to get on some departments. If you can go ahead and stoke that fire, if they realize going off to school or a trade school or whatever, that's what they want to do, then it'd be a great head start.
Rising junior Jeremy Wilson isn't considering a job in emergency services, but he says the camp has given him a greater understanding of what firefighters go through.
It's hot. I mean, in the gear, I mean, I really have a lot more respect for firemen now because the gear is, I mean, it's heavy, it's thick, it's protective, and it feels like you're being stuffed into a microwave.
Taylor White is 15 years old. He's wanted to be a firefighter since he was a kid, and today's training only solidified it in his mind.
I'm thinking their job is really hard, but I know that when you want to become a firefighter, you love doing your job. So I want to be that. I want to be a fireman.
In addition to the vehicle extrication exercise, participants learn and practice land navigation, train with law enforcement professionals, and meet the canine response team. They also learn about ham radio, air medical rescue, and learn hands-only CPR. To see a video of the Onslow County Emergency Preparedness Summer Camp, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. On Monday, the North Carolina Humanities Council starts a 5-week book group providing local veterans a place to share experiences and connect with other veterans in discussions of literature related to war and homecoming. Mac McKee speaks with Executive Director Paula Watkins about the bi-monthly program at the Havelock Craven County Public Library.
How did the North Carolina Humanities Council come up with the idea for a North Carolina Veterans book group?
Well, we've been part of a program that the Maine Humanities Council created called Literature and Medicine Humanities at the Heart of Healthcare, that we've run book discussion groups at hospitals for hospital staff, and we also ran them at veteran hospitals around the state. From that, Maine Humanities Council decided to start a pilot program just for veterans in veteran book groups. So we are one of the 13 states that is participating in the pilot program.
Are you just starting out to see what kind of demand it will be around the area, and if you see it to being successful, branching out to other bases in eastern North Carolina, such as Camp Lejeune, Seymour Johnson, or Fort Bragg?
I think we already know that the demand is definitely there. There are veterans who want to be engaged with other veterans around literature and humanities. So these pilots really are about testing methods, readings, formats, and really getting feedback from veterans so that we know what they need from the program, what will make it successful and interesting and engaging for them to really build a community for veterans around literature. But yes, to answer your question, we really hope that through these pilots, they do gain traction among veterans and other veteran groups around the state.
Now, how were the authors chosen for this particular pilot program?
Yeah, the authors and the readings were chosen through a collaborative process with veterans who gave us some suggestions, also the group facilitators for these groups, as well as suggestions from Maine Humanities Councils who are working with the other states with the pilot program. So we have a variety of authors and readings, and all of them attempt to reflect the diverse interests and concerns of veterans around the country. So it has a national feel to the readings. And the local groups really make the local community impact. They're reading anything from classics like Homer's Odyssey to contemporary short stories written by veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan.
C.S. Lewis once said, "We read to know we are not alone." Is it your hope that the healing power of literature can be one of the first steps for veterans to understand their relationship to the experiences of war and homecoming?
It's definitely our hope that these literature groups bring veterans together to find community. And through that, yes, we do already know that the literature brings healing to communities, not just veterans, and really helps everyone have a shared experience. It's not a group therapy program, but the literature group is to provide a setting and context so that they can connect with each other and build relationships and share their experiences.
Also understand they may be asked to contribute poetry of their own.
That's right. This is a really exciting process. And from some of these groups, we're hearing stories that really veterans who are expressing what they saw, expressing their heart and their mind.
When and where does this North Carolina Veterans Book Group meet here in Eastern North Carolina?
Well, the group will meet for 5 Monday nights this summer from 6:30 to 8 at the Havelock Craven County Public Library. The first meeting is June 29th, and the rest of the meetings will be July 13th, August 10th, September 1st, September 21st.
And if you need more information on the North Carolina Veterans Book Group, check out the events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Paula, thank you so much for being our guest today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Last week, we talked about some of the benefits of trees, including how they can help beautify your property, reduce your cooling bills, and create a more comfortable environment during the steamy summer months. And this summer looks like it's gearing up to be a hot one. As lovely as all this sounds, many property owners are understandably concerned about the threat that trees may pose to homes or businesses during a hurricane or tropical storm. After large storms, property owners often remove trees or choose not to replace fallen trees. And as a result, the tree populations in our coastal communities have dwindled. In response to this trend, the University of Florida conducted extensive research in the 90s and early 2000s to look at the relationship between trees and hurricanes. This research has revealed several steps that we can take to help ensure that trees on our properties are better able to weather future storms. The University of Florida study found that some species of trees are naturally more resistant to wind damage than others. Luckily, there are many good trees for our area that showed high levels of wind resistance. Some of those species include live oak, bald cypress, southern magnolia, the sable palm, crepe myrtle, and yaupon and American hollies. In the category of medium-high wind resistance were many of our favorites, including Japanese maple, river birch, Schumard oak, sweet bay magnolias, and hickories. If you are choosing new trees for your yard, look at species that rate medium to high in wind resistance to help reduce future damage potential. And avoid species that demonstrated poor survival in hurricanes. Common landscape trees that fared poorly in the University of Florida study include pecan, Bradford pear, Leland cypress, lacebark elm, red and silver maples, pines, laurel, water oak, and tulip poplar. The study also determined that trees growing in groups survived better and had less damage than trees growing as single specimens or planted in a row. So when you're planting trees, consider planting them as a grove with several specimens grouped together. If you include several different types of trees in the planting, you're also helping to maintain local diversity. If you have existing single trees in your landscape, consider planting additional trees and shrubs close by and mulching the entire area as a landscape bed. Not surprisingly, the study found trees with limited or damaged root systems were more vulnerable to failure. So when planting large trees, look for sites with deep soils that allow trees to develop a more extensive root system. If you're looking for new trees for the landscape, look for healthy plants with a straight trunk and a full crown. Unless a species is known for multiple trunks, like river birch is, avoid specimens that have more than one trunk or what are known in the industry as codominant leaders. These create weakness in the trunk over time. When it comes to mature trees, pruning larger trees and assessing tree health requires a specialized set of skills and knowledge. If you're concerned about the health and strength of trees on your property, contact a certified arborist to assess the situation. These steps, choosing the right trees and planting them in the right location, protecting them from damage, and appropriate pruning, can help us add trees to our coastal communities while reducing the risk of hurricane damage.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.